Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, a talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Education Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. Go to the website, TotalTutor.net, to find out more information on the Total Education Network. We're now syndicated 90-plus stations. Go to the website, check it out. I was on her birth through college tutoring and consulting company. Well, awesome guests today. Always the Total Education Network has the best education, and especially when we're talking about children's nonfiction children's books authors. Because in Ink Think Tank, it's fantastic. Vicki Cobb's crew, I mean, she has the best authors out there. They're so exciting, and I'm so glad to have a segment at each every other week with them. So I want to welcome the program, our author today, Dorothy Henshaw Patton. Dorothy, thanks for calling.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here with you, Neil.
All right, you're the author of The Horses and the Plain Indians. And it really, the story is about two major things, one, Native Americans, and the other, horses. So kids really can enjoy both of those things, learning about that, wouldn't they?
Yes, yes, that's what I love, the combination. And when I was a kid, they used to have, believe it or not, dime Saturday movies at the local theater, and we would walk over to the theater. And so many of these movies were, you know, westerns, and often cowboy and Indian stuff. And I watched how those Indians rode their horses, and I was just amazed at the ability that they had to, you know, like shoot arrows riding from the side of the horse and all of that. So I was into horses and Indians when I was quite young. And then when I was doing research for a previous book called The Buffalo and the Indians, A Shared Destiny, I realized how profoundly Indians had changed the Plains Indian culture. And I wanted to learn more about that and share that information with kids, because it just is such an amazing transformation.
Oh, absolutely. I think that kids, my daughter as well, I can't wait till the book comes in, because she is so into horses. I mean, she's in second grade, and I'm telling you, but she can read like on a fourth or fifth grade level. So both of us are teachers, so she has that ability, but she loves horses. And I guess to connect the love of animals, also learning about Native Americans, especially the Plain Indians, it's quite an interesting story to tell, isn't it?
Yes, yes, and I was one of those girls myself, you know, one of those horse-loving kids, and I was lucky enough to be able to have riding lessons and go, you know, rent horses to, and so forth. Once spent a week during the summer with a friend's place at a ranch that had their own horses, but never was able to have my own, unfortunately. So I have to live vicariously by writing about horses for other people.
All right, so tell us about the background of this of the book, and basically looking at the Plain Indians. There's a lot of research involved, isn't there?
Yeah, for any book, that any nonfiction book, and even actually for most fiction books, also the authors have to do a lot of background research to get their topic straight and to bring life into the project. So I use a variety of resources when I write, original documents when possible, books by experts. I like to interview people who are involved with it, and also personal experience. I'm very lucky because I live in Montana, where we have a lot of Indian reservations and a lot of Indians with horses. Two of the most important horse people are the Blackfeet and the Crow, and they both have reservations in Montana. So Bill Munoz, my photographer, and I both went up to the Blackfeet Reservation and watched the horses and talked to people. And we went to the Crow Reservation. They have a fabulous annual celebration called Crow Fair, where they have 1,000 teepees and a wonderful parade every morning, all dressed up in their finery. The kids are there with their own horses, just enjoying themselves, riding bareback and everything. So it was really a wonderful experience to do all this research. And I also had an Indian read the book for me to make sure I was not making any kinds of errors. So it was a wonderful project, and I loved every minute of it.
So when studying the love, I guess, the understanding of the relationship between horses and the Plain Indians, they really respected horses, didn't they? It was a really part of their way of life.
Yeah, and it was what happened was that we picture horses, the Plains Indians with horses all the time because that's what you see, of course, in westerns and so forth. But there was a period of time where they lived without horses. They didn't get horses until the Spanish came in the 1500s, and then later, in the later part of the 1500s, the Indians started to get to the tribes. But to get across the plains, I can't imagine hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of trudging. No, they didn't have wheels, so they had dogs, were their only domesticated working animals, and the dogs couldn't drag much weight with what they call a travois, which is like a harness. They put wood pieces and behind the dog, and then put stuff on it to drag. And it's really, dogs couldn't do more than maybe 70 pounds. And you figure teepees and everything. When the horses came and they could ride on the backs of the horses instead of trudging along, and when they could have the horses carrying that, dragging the travois with several times the weight a dog could, it totally transformed their society, made them much more mobile, so they could move long distances very easily. So it was a total change in the culture.
It definitely sounds like it. And I remember from study, because I have an undergrad in history and also teaching in elementary school, that really they had to learn to domesticate them in a way and understand them and see that, hey, that we can utilize them. When first they decided to utilize them, once the Spanish came in, they saw, hey, we don't have to stay in one place now. We can kind of go around. We can go and hunt further distances and really move our houses and stuff, right? They can move their teepees to other places all over the plains with that ability to have horses.
Yes, it made it much, much easier. It also made hunting buffalo a lot easier, because they used to have to do it and get a lot of people together. They'd have to move to a place where there was a buffalo jump, for example, where they could ride or force the buffalo to jump off a cliff and die, and they could get the meat and so forth. But with the horses, they could get one hunter could go out and get one buffalo by himself with a horse that's trained to hunt the buffalo. So it made huge. So many differences in the culture. And there's some funny kind of stories, because when the horses first came, they didn't know the people way north, like the Blackfeet. They didn't know the horses came from Spanish settlers. They didn't even know anything about the Spanish way back then, because they were so far away. But the horses worked their way north through the Indians. And when they got their first horse, they didn't know how to take care of it. They tried to feed it meat, because that's what dogs ate.
Right.
And the horse wouldn't eat the meat, and they tried to play games of fetch with it, tossing a stick and hoping the horse would retrieve the stick, which is kind of a funny image. But, they had to learn how to take care of these animals. And within a generation, they became some of the best horsemen in the world.
It's
quite amazing.
Absolutely. And I guess that they saw, again, their love for understanding how much they use the buffalo for everything, from their food to their clothing to their way of life. Now they had the ability to hunt the buffalo much easier and track the buffalo much easier with the horses. So that really changed their society in so many ways. And I'm sure in your book you talk about that as well.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a whole bunch of information, about that, the changes in how they hunted. And also they ended up with a lot more warfare, because they had the perfect instrument, for carrying out war in the horse. So they could raid another tribe and take their horses away, and then the other tribe would come back and try to get their horses back. The horse was really the symbol of wealth and power for the Indians within a couple of generations.
And so they were the big group in a way, because they had the horses. They were able to go ahead and conquer other tribes.
Right, right. And it was, people get upset about the idea of quote unquote horse stealing, but it was part of the culture. It was considered a challenge. See if you could get the other guy's horses. and then the other guy would try to get the horses back. And it was really, it wasn't considered like a crime, like stealing something from somebody in the same way that, that you would normally see, you know, private property being purloined. It was an honor thing with the Indians, and they all did it. So it wasn't considered bad if somebody, you know, stole horses. He wasn't a bad person. He was doing an honorable thing, bringing more horses back to his people.
What was one thing that you learned from research about the Plain Indians that you didn't know before? Was there something really that came out from your research?
Well, I sort of had a general concept of the relationship because of having, first place, always been interested in horses and living out in the West and having written the book about the buffalo and the horse. But there was one thing about the book that was really hard for me that I didn't know that I was going to be including necessarily is the change of the culture after European Americans arrived and wanted to take over the plains. And there were the Indians on the plains, and so there were a lot of warfare between whites and Indians. And one of the things that the horse was like a brother to the Indians. It was like one of them. And the idea of living without horses just was something they couldn't comprehend. But the whites wanted to get rid of the Indians, and that meant, you know, taking their horses away. So it was a really terrible time for the people to when they were taken to reservations and they had their horses taken away and they sent the kids off to Indian schools. And I talk about this in the book, and it was very depressing for me to relive that shameful part of our history, and to think about, you know, these poor kids who were deprived of their culture and their horses and their families by being sent to these schools.
It was terrible. Our government made some bad mistakes, as they make a lot of times, and also in history of our country, we've made mistakes. But yet we've responded in different ways. And as you see the Native Americans, how they've gone through such a tough life since we've come to the United States, that really they I really have had some hard times. They really can't live off their land like they did before, and it's hard for them, right? Even when you went back to research, especially being where you live.
Yes, it is very hard, and they have very hard lives today because, of course, the lands we actually left them for the reservations, and in some cases, are not the best land. You know, we took the best land for the whites, I should say, because it wasn't you and me, but the white people took the best land for themselves and gave the Indians the land that was not so great and expected them to turn from hunters into farmers just like that when they didn't know farming and it wasn't part of their lifestyle to farm. But one of the things that is really wonderful today is that a lot of the tribes are gaining back their pride and feeling of strength through horses.
That's great.
And for example, there are these kids, Sioux Indians and other Indians, that do a endurance ride. Bill Munoz followed them part of the way when we were working on the book, in sub-zero temperatures, riding their horses across the plains and the mountains to honor the Indians who died at the Wounded Knee Massacre. And this is a rite of passage for these kids. One of the girls said that she had that this was such a hard ride that now the idea of law school, which was where she was heading after the ride, was a piece of cake. They're using horses. Help bring back their sense of pride in who they are, and it's wonderful.
That's fantastic, and I'm sure you love living in this country, in the area that you live in, just so that you can see horses, because of your love of horses when you were young, and you get to write about them, and how cool is that? So, Dorothy, where can we find more information on you? I know that one place we can go is inkthinktank.com to check out your bio and information about being one of the authors on Ink Think Tank. Fantastic resource. There's a lot of different things that they could check out from listening to my radio show, interviews with the authors, plus some videos and much, much more. But also, you have a website as well to purchase the book and everything, right?
Yes, and I have my own personal website, which is very, very simple. It's DorotheyHinshawPatent.com, all like one word. You just have to be sure to spell Hinshaw, H-I-N-S-H-A-W, and patent is P-A-T-E-N-T. So it's DorotheyHinshawPatent.com.
All right.
It's a long. But that's the name I write under because I didn't want my maiden name to disappear. And I've actually had a couple people find me because I write under that name. So people I used to know when I was a kid.
That's cool. Once you get out in that World Wide Web, you never know who can discover you. Well, thanks again for calling the program. Look forward to having you back on, especially with the new books that come out and being and sharing with us a great story and also your love for horses. So thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil. I've enjoyed it a lot.
I did, too. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to the Toll Education Show on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Toll Education Spotlight Show on the Toll Education Network. Remember, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. I have been just swamped with interviews. It's a lot of fun, I guess, when you have your studio and you can do it anytime and any place. Well, I guess the days of yesterday, the days of when I was just doing the Toll Education Hour and it was my year anniversary, one of my first major guests was Dr. Shelley Hipsky. And what I'm amazed about is her growth, I guess my growth as well, but her growth, especially since the first time we met and talked on the phone. And now about two years later, she is just becoming this big time superstar. So I want to welcome the program, Dr. Shelley Hipsky. How are you?
Well, thank you. I think you're a superstar too, Neil.
Well, I'm hoping so. I guess I'm becoming the person who interviews celebrities, so it's a lot of fun. And I consider you definitely with what you've been able to accomplish lately. But let's talk about how you got into the TV game now. You're an author. You've been on the radio many times. But what made you want to go ahead and do a television show?
Well, you know, when I was doing the last book, The Ordinary People, Extraordinary Planet, there were so many wonderful stories of people who had risen above and now they're giving back. And then I started forming these amazing friendships with them, Neil. Like, you know, we have a great friendship, you and I do. And I just started these amazing relationships with people, and I wanted to spread their word, and I wanted to spread it globally. I wanted to get it out there and really spotlight what they're doing and empower them and their organizations. So it was just a really natural fit. You know, I love being on the stage or in front of a classroom, so being in front of the camera was just a really easy progression for me.
Well, and I think that especially any teacher, if they want to go ahead and try to be a talk show host, it's not hard if they really put a lot of time and effort and are not afraid to make mistakes, to learn from their mistakes, and specific enough. I think that your experience getting and doing a lot of radio, being involved in movies, doing interviews, it was really simple for you to go right in front of the camera for a TV
show. It really was. It really was. And one of the stories from the book spun off into a documentary, and I was the host of that documentary, so that really helped as well.
So
get comfortable.
Yeah, so you were getting used to it. Next, we're going to tell me you're going to have a reality television show. I know that's next.
Oh, no. that's my husband's idea. He wants to do that. I don't need that. I'd much rather spotlight other people.
See, I want to have a reality television show, so I've already said that I'm pushing for that. I just have to get enough popularity. So now tell us about it. I mean, I guess what happened was you said, hey, after your book and especially helping and seeing these people who have inspiring lives, that have gone through lots of hardship, you said, well, I'm going to make it a TV show. So what was the process in doing that?
What was the process?
Yeah.
Well, I knew that I wanted to do this, so I took a camera crew to New York City during Couture Fashion Week there, and we just started taping people. I came up with my formula for my show, for Inspiring Lives with Dr. Shelley, and we just kind of took it on the road and got some great pilot footage, and then I was approached by Brandon Takas over at WPXI to put it together for a PCNC show here in Pittsburgh, and it's been wonderful. Then we got picked up in Manhattan by the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and then they globally stream it. So we get feedback from everywhere from Indonesia to Africa. So it's been a really wonderful international journey.
And what I see specifically enough is that's the start. You just go ahead and then you go and you just play it like it's the big time. And before you know it, you get bigger and bigger. And I saw one of your posts on Facebook. You have goals to make this a huge nationally syndicated television show, don't you?
Absolutely. I'm working with Jana Pinnell out of Hollywood, and she's helping me pull together my reel. So, you know, this little Pittsburgh show could be the show that could. And it really, it's not because of me and what I'm doing. It's because of the people that I've been able to feature, from people who have dealt with homelessness to domestic violence to anorexia and these huge issues. And then they go on and they help other people. So it's been great.
And I want to have you on the show to kind of tell us specifically what type of topics you're covering for the month, things like that, so we can continue to stay in touch. And what's nice now is I can just schedule you anytime. We just go ahead and do this, and then people listening will hear you with all these other very, very interesting people. But tell us a bit about some of the guests that have been on the show, because I know the one that's going to air, that probably won't air now, but I know they can go to the website and watch all the archive shows at one point in time. The one that you had that's going to air very soon, that I met her at the National Publicity Summit. That was just...
Oh, Gertrude! Yeah. I love Gertrude, and actually it's been a real blessing, because I don't know if you know this, Neil, but she is our International Rooney Scholar. We got her here from New Zealand by way of Zimbabwe. She's an amazing woman who has the Africa Alive program, which takes people to Africa, and they get to use their skill sets to help people that are in Africa, particularly the children that are orphans due to HIV and AIDS, which of course is very near and dear to my heart, because my family, I grew up doing some volunteer work with my family in the AIDS population here in America, and then she and I just really bonded over that. So she's just been a fascinating person to have here in Pittsburgh, and she's doing a lot of speaking around the area as well.
Well, and that's tremendous, and that's what, again, the stories that you talked about in your book. I remember last time I interviewed you was on WRCT about a year later after your book, and specifically enough, what this show's all about is inspiring people by how they gave back in specific ways to help others, and Gertrude
exactly. Absolutely
did it. I had her on my show as well. Amazing what she's doing for... Again, it was just an unbelievable story. But there's tons of unbelievable stories on your show, right?
There really are. I mean, from like Dawn Diaz with Milagros Day Worldwide, she came in from New York City, and she is just an incredible woman. She has survived 2 decades of domestic violence and pulled herself up, and that now she has this organization that helps other women not only realize what situation they're in, but then to pull themselves up and figure out what their dreams and their goals are to reach other people. So it's very much empowering others so they can empower others, which is just been beautiful. And she wowed us in the studio, because I knew that she was also a Latina woman captain of the New York Fire Department in the paramedics department. But what I didn't know was that she was there during 9/11. And that episode took an amazing turn. And it's been fantastic, because I do know these people, everyone that in the 13 episodes that I did for this particular season, the first season, are dear, dear friends of mine, and we've just made these incredible connections. And I very often I'm helping them with their initiatives as well. For example, Alicia Kozakiewicz, who was the first cyber predator kidnapping in the United States, and she and I have now worked with the National Child Abuse Prevention Month and doing their poster contest and doing the Alicia Project and getting her more publicity for all of the initiatives that she's doing, and her helping with through social media, finding different children in the Pittsburgh area and around the country and keeping kids safe. So it's just, there's so many initiatives going on here.
You're staying so busy and still being a professor. I mean, it's just amazing how you're able to do everything.
Thank you. Well, I am a teacher first and foremost. So teaching in the education department at Robert Morris has been wonderful for the last 8 years, and I'm still loving getting up and going and teaching my classes. Because if you teach a teacher, you're teaching the next generation, and I can continue to do that and been great being able to, it's been tricky being able to juggle that with motherhood of two kids, but it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
It's amazing what you're able to do. And I think when we specifically see your growth and where you're going, you are all the time are looking to help others. And I think that's the key thing, especially my radio show. I look to really promote others, educate others, and really put out an experience where educators finally have a voice. And that's what, and then also with the celebrities and their charities, because the mainstream radio does not allow that opportunity. And I think that your show, a lot of places, they can't get that kind of publicity that you're giving them.
It's very true. And one of the other things that's been great about it is our gratitude giving segments. I have a co-host, Jen Hain. She's a wonderful young woman right out of college, and she's doing a fantastic job with the gratitude giving segments. My concept behind that was to take these different amazing charities around the globe that are taking a huge percentage of their proceeds and giving it back to help in these different areas in the world, from the Tegu toys. They have these amazing wooden toys from the rainforests of Honduras, to the Signing Works dolls that were distributed to over 4,000 schools for the deaf around the country to help kids be able to talk with their dolls. They have these little hands. I know you'll appreciate this because you're a teacher at heart, but they have the hands can be bent to so that they can sign with their dolls. So essentially they can talk with their doll like our kids do with their dolls.
That's great.
So it's like there's so many different amazing projects and products out there that people can tap into and get on board and get them for Christmas gifts and those type of things. And the money goes back to the right places. They go back to the nonprofits. They go back to restoring the rainforest. They go towards helping these women that are recovering from domestic violence. And so that's just a really quick segment that we have on every show highlighting one of those charities and how you can either use their products or use their services to make a difference in the world.
Well, I'm glad you're on my show, especially because, again, the radio show is heard in two stations in Canada, two stations in the UK. So we're trying to grow internationally. We're heard in 180 countries, just like your program. But I think that what you're doing is something different. And I think that's what
we
need. We need something like this. We need to highlight people that are making a difference. All that we're doing is being divisive right now, leading to the election. But a show like yours is really making people want to make a difference. Because if one person can help that next person who can help that next person, our society would be much better. Really
oh,
well.
My gosh. If everybody just used their skill sets that they have, and everybody has something to give. And if you just went out of your way just a little bit of the day or even a little bit of the week or month, my goodness, we would be in such a wonderful spot. It's all about paying it forward and not always asking, what do I get out of it? It's because your heart's going to get filled up and you're going to feel good and you're going to walk a little lighter and feel a little prouder. And I think that there's really something to that, Neil. And I see others around the world doing the same thing. And now it's coming to the TV near you or the computer if you have to watch it through globally streaming until we get national syndication.
Hey, but I'm going to tell you right now, you get YouTube, you make this viral, you don't even need to get another television station. You'll help so many people and be known all over the world. They're the most popular. It's amazing. The internet's the wave of the future. We'll get used to this very soon, that we won't need broadcast radio or television. It'll all be streamed on internet, and that'll be the wave of the future, because we want to go globally. We're international shows. Why?
Exactly.
We can't just look at local. We're both on local. We're both international. And I look forward to having you on a monthly basis to tell us about some of the projects that are coming up with you. So where can we find more information on you, watch the TV show, and learn more about Dr. Shelley?
Okay, so to watch the television show, if you're in Pittsburgh, you go to PCNC. So that's Armstrong 31 and Comcast 35. If you're in New York City, God bless you with Hurricane Sandy. I hope you're doing okay if you're out there. And it's on MNN, which is Channel 34 there. And if you would like to watch it globally stream, that is on Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and that is on MNN.org. Now, all of this information can be found on www.inspiringlivesinternational.com. Let me say that one more time, www.inspiringlivesinternational.com. And the PCNC viewers out there in Pittsburgh, please tune in on Mondays at 7:30 p.m.